Now for something completely different, which is actually going to be true for all the talks. We have Robin Rothersdam talking about practical evolution, harnessing variation and selection in rational drug discovery.
Good morning. I'd really like to thank you all for coming this morning, and I'd like to thank Lynn especially for giving me the invitation to speak. I think what you're going to find is two women with Dutch last names are going to be both very practical in our talks. So not quite as practical as killing bugs, using bugs, but that is kind of the focus of my talk this morning. So I'm a biologist. I'm a cell biologist and a molecular pharmacologist. And I've spent the last 17 years at undergraduate colleges. One was an evangelical college, and one is, and I'm now at a Catholic university. And when we teach about evolution, and when we talk about evolution, this is really the kind of ideas that you have in your mind. Well, first you have the monkey to man progression, right? But that's too trite to throw up here. But you have some idea of changing in a lineage through time, or maybe you have a tree of life where you have relationships between different species over time. And I can get my students to understand these concepts, and I can get them to answer questions correctly on the test, but frequently what I get is, okay, so what does it matter if I accept this or not, right? And what I'm test driving on you folks today, so I really am eager to get to the question part, is this idea that evolutionary biology can really matter in something that we Christians are called to do, and that is to heal and reduce suffering in this world. So my hope is to show you this morning that some principles of evolution, protein homologies, the conservation of biochemical pathways, and then those foundational processes of variation and selection are really useful in a very practical research project. So I'm a molecular pharmacologist. The disease that I am focused on right now in my lab's work is called McCune-Albright syndrome. This is one of the orphan diseases in our world. So the National Institutes of Health calls anything with, I think it's 100,000 or fewer people affected by it, an orphan disease. This disease, McCune-Albright syndrome, affects probably a couple hundred people in America today. It's a rare genetic disorder. It is caused by a mutation that happens during embryonic development. So you don't inherit it from your parents. It's like cancer in that it's a mutation that happens during your lifetime. It's just it happened during your very early lifetime for these people. So we call that a mosaic. Most of the tissues in the patient are unaffected by the mutation, but those few that are derived from that cell that migrated or divided or differentiated into a variety of different tissues. There's a classic triad of symptoms associated with McCune-Albright syndrome: precocious puberty, which means a very abnormally early onset of puberty, as early as 2 or 3, very, very early. Café au lait hyperpigmentation, which you can see in this picture. This is a classic picture from the NIH database. Hyperpigmentation of the skin. And then this little girl is actually in a cast from her waist down. The third symptom, and the most devastating one, is a bone malformation called polyostotic fibrous dysplasia. And usually in all of us, because we're all standing and walking just fine this morning, when your bone cells lay down the collagen fibers, they lay them down parallel to each other, and that provides more mechanical strength. And in fact, there's parallel and there's different layering, sort of like plywood, to give you extra strength in your bone. In the affected bone tissue, those collagen fibers are just dropped on the floor like if you would drop a box of toothpicks. So you don't get that mechanical strength to the bone. In the weight-bearing bones, that causes bending over time and frequent fractures. A lot of the little boys are diagnosed by visiting the ER so often with fractures when they're little. It also, the bone malformations also cause facial asymmetry in the facial bones. we know what causes this. We know exactly what gene is mutated. It's called the GS protein, and there are three different mutations all at the same position that can cause the disease. And what, for this generalist audience, what I want you to know about GS is that it works like a light switch, right? Sometimes the light is on, sometimes the light is off. Oh, yeah, this one has a delay, right? Sometimes the light's on, sometimes the light's off, but it's really important in cell biology for these switching proteins to go both ways. So I think one theme in biology, which the physiologists would all appreciate, is if you turn it on, you got to turn it off. And the disease happens because we can't turn the switch off. So what does this look like at the cell level? This is a membrane on a cell in your body. Up here is the outside. Down here is the inside of the cell. And in our cells, we have signals, hormones, that are floating around in our bloodstream that bind to responsive cells through a receptor. And the yellow circle here is the GS protein. So when you get the signal, the light switch goes on. And it does things and makes things happen. Okay, this slide was for a more biology audience. I'm just going to say it does things and makes things happen. Okay, so we can all go with that. So we have a response. Now we have to turn it off, right? So the switch has an automatic, the yellow GS protein has an automatic off switch. It will switch GTP back to GDP, and then the response stops. So you want to have the response when the hormone's around. If the hormone's still around, it'll continue the cycle again and be reactivated. But if the hormone disappears, which things like parathyroid hormone that control your bone development do disappear, you have a cycle of high and low PTH every day. If it disappears, the signal goes away. In McCune-Albright syndrome, we don't have that off switch. And so that response is happening all the time. And that results in thinking that there are pro-puberty hormones around when there aren't. And so you start producing extra estrogen, testosterone, and progesterone when you shouldn't be. It results in thinking that you should be producing more melanin, even though you haven't been exposed to ultraviolet light, or your genetics don't tell you to do that. And it results in abnormal bone formation as well. All right. So I would like to fix this. We don't have a good fix for this other than sending these, especially for the bone disease, other than sending the kids to the operating room an awful lot during their childhood. And those surgeries are less than 50% effective as well. So a lot of pins, a lot of plates, just a whole lot of pain too as well. So my goal is to find some drug that will target the abnormal protein, leave the normal protein alone, because you need that normal one to work for a lot of other things, and just fix this broken light switch. Okay, so a very practical, directed research project for my lab. So how does this relate to evolutionary biology? Well, in all honesty, these foundational principles of evolution are what allow me to set up my research program and actually design some of the techniques that I've been using. So the first part, I'm going to tell you about setting up a model system for McCune-Albright syndrome. There are 300 of these patients, right? You cannot go into humans and start doing these experiments. You need a model system for doing that. And so I'm going to look at conservation biochemical pathways and protein homologies here. And then we'll talk about using variation and selection a little later. Okay, so you might not think about it, but the yeast that they use in the cafeteria to make the bread, at some factory, to make the bread you had for toast this morning, share a very similar biochemical pathway to the pathway that's disrupted in McCune-Albright syndrome. So here's a cute little picture of the budding yeast. And what budding yeasts do is they live in two sexes, and they need to find each other to mate and sporulate to survive dry and extreme conditions out on the grape leaf in the vineyard, right? So yeasts do not live in Fleischmann's packages, right? That is not their part in the ecosystem. But out on the in ecosystems, actually where Valerie might run into them, they need to find their mating partners to survive winter and to survive drought. And what they do is they release pheromones, and the two sexes in yeast are called A and alpha, and they release pheromones and find each other and fuse, and then they can sporulate and survive. Well, the process they use to do this is exactly the same set of proteins that we use to form bone and to trigger puberty and to determine melanin formation. So they don't have hormones, they have pheromones, which bind to receptors. The receptors activate that same family of G protein that I've colored yellow here, and then they have a response. And in yeast, the response is to stop growing, stop DNA replication, to be very specific. If you're going to fuse with another cell, you want to make sure you have the right number of chromosomes. If you've copied your chromosomes already, that would be a bad thing, because then you'd have three sets instead of two, and then division goes berserk. So cell cycle arrest, or stopping growing, is the response to this. The protein, the G protein, is very similar at the amino acid level. So on this picture, I've got the yeast on the top line. I know you can't see it, so we're just going to be looking at colors. Yeast on the top line, three human G proteins. You have 17 of them. On the next three lines, a nematode and a fruit fly G protein. And then the bottom one is the conservation. Anything that's green or warmer is similar to identical. And so you can see that there are some differences. In fact, that, you know, this region right here has a big insertion in the non-mammalian G proteins. But for the most part, there's a very high conservation of amino acid sequences, which turns into, if you have the same building blocks, you build the same structure. And in biology, structure determines function. So if it's shaped the same, it's probably going to do a very similar task here. All right, so the question then is, if we make this change in the yeast G protein, does it mess up its function in the same way that it messes up our GS protein? So can we break the switch in yeast? If we have an overactive G protein in yeast, we're going to have permanent cell cycle arrest. So we're not going to be able to get the cells to grow. And I'm not going to tell you the details of how I manipulate the system so that they grow sometimes, and then when I want to do the experiment, they stop. But there's a way to do that. If there are yeast geneticists, I'd be happy to geek out with you over that. All right, but here's the picture, right? You can see that with normal G protein here, we have cells growing under these conditions. When we put the mutation that's in the homologous site to the disease mutation into the yeast, they don't grow. So we've got a model system that allows us to basically give yeast McCune-Albright syndrome. Now, how does this relate to finding a molecule to fix it? Here, I'm not going to use natural variation and natural selection. I'm going to be the one doing the variation, and I'm going to be applying the selection to this process. Here's the logic. Back to our yeast system. An active G protein isn't going to let the yeast grow. But if I put a second mutation in that G protein, I mutate the heck out of it, you know. Some of those mutations might fix that light switch and turn it back off. So the idea is a second mutation will inactivate the system and then let the yeast cells grow again. So this is a diagram of the yeast G protein gene. We introduced random mutations into that. We used degenerative PCR, for those of you in the audience who care about that system, basically blindly mutated that gene. We created a library, so a collection of these mutations. We have 7,800 different mutations in that gene, and we screened that library, so we looked at those, we looked at 55,000 of them. And this is really actually quite easy to do, because if they aren't what you're looking for, they don't live. They don't grow. Under these conditions, this is a plate that probably has, it probably has 1,000, you know, a petri plate this big, has 1,000 different yeast colonies plated on it. and only the red ones here are actually growing. Right? So you can deal with 55 plates. That's, you know, three sleeves of 20. That's no problem. That's a short week in the lab. So we screened through 55,000 clones to make sure that we had seen every one of those mutations in the library. So we on average, looked at each of them 8 times. We pulled out 424 colonies the first time. We retested them. Only 38 remained positive in our screen, right? So here we've got the variation and the selection. You keep selecting to make sure that you're not going to have to do more work than you need to. And then of those 39, 14 of those mutations occurred at positions in the G protein that were really similar to a position in the human G protein. So I showed you that diagram of the alignments, and there was that blue insert. Actually, a lot of them ended up being in the blue insert, which tells you something could be a side project interesting about how does that yeast G protein work differently from ours, or does that have a different additional function put into it? But we found 14 of them that were similar, so we can do something with that. We want to ask now, does it really matter back in the human? So if we introduce these 14 secondary mutations into the human G protein, do we fix this and get rid of that response? All right. The answer is sometimes. So homology is not identity. So saying that this is at the homologous site does not mean that it's always going to work in the human system. This graph shows measuring that response to hormone in my human cells. So normal G protein has a low response in the absence of hormone. The McCune-Albright allele in red has a high response in the absence of hormone. Most of the secondary mutations did nothing to really reduce that response, but we had 3 sites where if you mutate the second site, it corrected the defect. So we're going to follow on with those. This is a structure of the G protein. And we have one at right here at phenylalanine 142, and another up here on the green loop at leucine 266, and then a third one on this red loop at arginine 231. If you were a G protein aficionado, you would say, oh, two of them are in switches. So switches are places in the protein that move when the protein changes from active to inactive. So seeing things in switches, that was a good sign. We liked to see that. Some of them are found in places that, you know, are hard to think about targeting a drug to. And we said to ourselves, well, we randomly mutated, right? So you get what changes you get. But if, for example, at arginine 231, we started with a cysteine there. What happens if you change it to other things? Because it just randomly changed to cysteine. Let's now deliberately change it to other amino acids. And what we saw, at least at this site, is that pretty much changing anything else at this site, even some very conservative mutations, arginine to lysine, reduce that activity, which is telling you that if you mess with this point, it really changes the function. This is a really important spot on the G protein for the switch function to happen. All right. I am not going to mutate people. Okay. Jim will tell you how you can mutate people later on Monday, right? But I'm not going to do it. Let's go with that. I'm not going to mutate people. What I want to do is I want to design a molecule that's going to do the same thing that this mutation does, right? So if I know that on this spot, on the surface of the G protein, if I mess with that arginine, I change the function. I can mess with it by changing that arginine, or I can mess with it by targeting a small molecule to stick at that spot and hopefully tickle it in the same way. So my goal is to find something to bind to that mutated G protein and turn it off. How do we choose that target site? Phenylalanines are big, fatty amino acids that clump together like a glob of olive oil, and they're buried deep in the protein. I'm never going to be able to find a molecule that you can swallow, have dissolve in your stomach, burrow into a protein, and stick at that spot. Leucine is actually in the same condition. So the arginine is the only one that's on the surface of the protein that would be accessible to a molecule sticking to it. So we use these kind of practical structural-based considerations for that. And this is what we want to do. The green blobby stuff here is the surface of the G-protein molecule. We know this from X-ray crystallography. And this molecule right here is sitting in a pocket that is right next to, right here actually, is this blue thing right here, is arginine 231. So it is sticking in a pocket right in that location on the G protein. How did I find this? You use the power of computers. There is a database at the University of California, San Francisco, that allows you to take a protein structure, define a region on the surface of that structure. In fact, you can also define slight mutations in that structure and model those mutations if you want to. But you define a surface on the structure of that protein, and it will dock the 35 million purchasable compounds that are in its database one by one and give you some information on the energy of binding. It takes a little while. So you run it over, I think this took about a week of computing time. Right, you get in line, and all of you who pay taxes to the American government, thank you, because that's one of the good things that came out of NIH funding. So what we did is we actually didn't look at all 35 million. We defined them by molecular size. You don't want a big molecule for a drug. You want something that's got a molecular weight under 300 or so. We defined them by how hydrophobic they were, how many hydrogen bond acceptors and donors they had, and stuff like that. And we came up with, the list of 45 of the best possible candidates. And I ordered 28 of them because commercially available is a loosely used term. And commercially available may mean that there's someone in Lithuania willing to synthesize it for you. But these were like things that were on a shelf that someone could ship to me in a matter of weeks. And so what we found now is we have two drug candidates that are kind of lead compounds for us. Drug number three is not all that great. Those are some pretty big error bars. But you see that as you add more of the drug, you reduce the response. We're measuring the response on the y-axis there. And drug 18 is actually, we're actually pretty happy about looking at drug 18. So we have gotten to a point where we are ready to do a few more experiments to convince people that this is a useful potential idea, and then start collaborating with synthetic organic chemists to add bells and whistles to molecule 18 and see if we can get something better out of that. And so that's where we're at. It was on my bucket list to get a molecule to the screening stage. And so this is something I'm very, very excited about. So in conclusion, what I've shown today is that McCune-Albright syndrome, a human genetic disease, can be modeled at the cellular level using yeast. And really what I did was I used protein homologies and homologous biochemical pathways, those foundational principles of evolution, to set up this model system. We found suppressors of the McCune-Albright mutation, and I didn't show you the data that showed that they didn't abolish GS signaling in there, and I didn't show you this data either, but it works for all three of the mutations, not just the one we started with. I got that data by using the principles of variation and selection. Now again, not natural variation, not natural selection, but by using those foundations of how biological life works in my research lab. And we've identified two molecules that inhibit this G protein in a dose-dependent manner. And so I'm happy to report that, you know, evolutionary biology is being used on the path to treating human disease. So that's where I'm at. I welcome your questions.
Yes, sir. Sorry. a log and then molar.
Log and then molar.
Yeah. Okay. No, that was not molar.
Do you have? Can you get those cells and culture the human cells from the disease, the McCune-Albright cells? Can they be cultured?
No. I don't know that they can.
Or are they? Do they exist?
But we don't have them. We don't have a cell line. That would be a really nice model system. What some folks are actually working on is making a mouse model of the disease. The tricky thing is if you do a germline mutation so that all the cells in the mouse have the disease, you don't make it past embryonic day 5. So.
You need a switchable.
You need a switchable one. I think probably switchable and tissue specific. Yes.
So, at what stage do you anticipate administering the drug to patients?
Well, this isn't something you screen for because it's a mutation that arises during embryonic development, right? So, you would have the very earliest that you could give this to a patient would be after diagnosis. Today, most kids are diagnosed between the ages of 3 and 5. Mm-hmm. Since it's rare, it's usually a long path to diagnosis because not every pediatrician is thinking this right away, and nor should they. There are other causes of precocious puberty and other causes of bone malformation that you should be really concerned with. But you would probably already have significant bone disease by the time that you ran into it. So the hope would be that the cells could repair, the normal cells in the area could repair that lesion. Yes.
So I might have missed it. You mentioned that your rescue mutations are in switches, but where is the original mutation?
The original mutation is in the GTP binding site, so it's one of the arginines that coordinates the water that hydrolyzes GTP.
Okay.
Yes?
I imagine that a story like this helps students to see the value of evolution at the micro level. Do you see this kind of thing leading to openness at the macro level too for resistant students?
Do you mean like speciation and those kinds of things? I would hope so. In all honesty, I'm test driving this on you guys for the first time ever, so I haven't actually told the story in this way before. If I had to predict, I would predict it would be a tough sell. Mm-hmm. I think that students are the model system is a strong bit of evidence, right, though? So I think that you probably have to be looking at that model system for at least common ancestry, right, as part of that story.
Well, there is one piece that might apply to that, and that is the extreme homology that Robin showed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That you're going from yeast to human.
Yeah.
And it's not the same protein, but it's doing the same thing.
Right.
And I think that's a pretty strong argument.
Yeah.
On a macro level.
Right.
I don't know if you care or not, but sometimes with my cell biology students, I use the idea of Legos. So have you ever been to Legoland?
Yeah.
They build a whale here, and they build New York City there, and the building blocks are all the same.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
And so that G protein that God put in yeast,
right,
he tweaked a little bit and built something different as a sex hormone signaling cascade in your body. And that sort of, and sometimes that helps them sort of look in that direction, yeah, if not take a big step.
I like that analogy also for domains within proteins,
yes,
right? Because those are like mix and match,
DNA
build binding. A GTP binding site, yeah, build a cyclase interaction site, yeah.
Dr. Dennis Noble talks about the one-armed bandit, like the slot machine with the cherries and the oranges and the bananas, where immune systems and genetic changes work like you're holding these ones constant, and then you're rolling the third one until you get what you want. So
until you find something that works.
Right. Well, right.
That's
yes,
the difference,
yes,
there, right?
And
yeah,
what you did, to use Dennis's language, was you harnessed stochasticity.
Yes.
Until you got, yeah, and that,
right,
and
that's
it,
right.
It wasn't a completely random thing that you did. You.
Oh no,
right.
No. We pointed at,
right,
this gene, right, and this number of mutations per construct, and yeah, we very much had parameters on that mutagenesis.
Yes,
we did. All right, thank you.
Thank you.